The second case for oral argument this morning is Kelly and Michelle McCallum, appellants versus Neil D. Cahill, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. John Burke, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Melissa Neville, an attorney from Aberdeen. Mr. Burke, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the court, it's my privilege to appear before you today on behalf of my clients who are also in attendance and argue their case. Today we're going to ask you to reverse the trial court's decision, specifically to reverse his grant of specific performance and to also reverse his denial of rescission. Briefly, Your Honor, there are three things I want to touch upon today. I understand that we cannot retry our case here. I understand that I do not have much time. So for that reason, there are three things I'm going to talk about. Specifically, I want to talk about some findings of fact that are flatly incorrect when you review the record. Secondly, I want to talk about the fact that to have specific performance, for the seller to have obtained specific performance in this case, he needed to have unclean hands, which he cannot show, which he did not show. And finally, the trial court improperly raised our burden of proof and required that rather than we simply show snakes on the property or an inordinate amount of snakes, we needed to show a snake problem, per se, however that may be defined. For the benefit of the justices and the fact that we have students here today, I will briefly go through the facts, even though I know that you have had the benefit of the party's briefs. Your Honors, the plaintiffs, Kelly and Michelle McCollum, moved from Winter, South Dakota to Mobridge, South Dakota in the fall of 2004. They became aware that Mr. Cahill's house was for sale. Kelly had been transferred there. He was a 17-year employee with the Department of Transportation. They looked at the house, met with Mr. Cahill on a handful of occasions, and eventually negotiated through Mr. Gosh and with Mr. Cahill for the purchase of the property. They were provided a property disclosure statement as required in South Dakota. It is undisputed that in response to the question, are there any other problems with the house that have not been disclosed above, it was checked no. That's not disputed. There were meetings between the parties, and that is frankly the subject of probably why we're here in terms of what was disclosed orally. In any case, my clients, assuming that this house was maybe like any other, moved into the house and promptly began to discover snakes. What we later found out after a case was commenced was that Mr. Cahill had in fact killed a bull snake in his living room. He was willing to admit that. He had killed a snake in the garage. He admitted that. And he admitted to at least one other snake in the yard, although the trial court found that he had occasionally observed snakes in the yard. My clients also found Snake Away, two containers of a snake repellent with the clever name Snake Away that is no longer produced, that was in the house. And Mr. Cahill was the only owner of the house. He had had it constructed some 30 years before. We also know that Mr. Cahill had a handyman. His name was John Opseth. He's a local Finnish carpenter who does handiwork on the side. And over the years, Mr. Cahill would have Mr. Opseth come and do all sorts of little items around the house. Initially at trial, Mr. Opseth was unwilling to admit that he came to the house to deal with the snake issue. However, he was reminded during cross-examination that during his deposition, he had testified that after Cahill had found the snake in the living room and killed it with a carpet sample, that he had went out to the house and attempted to find where the snake had gained entrance. Mr. Cahill was not the only person that ever saw a snake on that property. We later found through depositions in the trial that his neighbor, Ms. Shell, who's a key witness in this case, and we're going to talk about her testimony a little bit later, because the court's finding that there was an oral disclosure is based almost entirely upon Ms. Shell's testimony that she was there when Cahill allegedly told my clients orally that he had killed a snake in the house. In any case, Ms. Shell initially testified that she had never seen snakes on the property, never seen a snake. After some cross-examination, she admitted that she had seen a dead one in the driveway, a dead one hanging over a fence, and maybe a snake skin coming out of a hole. Other witnesses at trial included several employees of Mr. Cahill's accounting firm who apparently visited the house over the years to retrieve files. Interestingly, most of these witnesses had seen dead snakes on occasion. Ms. Reichert testified that she had maybe seen 5 to 10, and at least two of them were laid on a, or accidentally died, or laid, however it may be, on a concrete patio if you walk out the sliding door. Another witness said she saw a couple, and so we have a number of snakes that are seen on the property over the years. My client's testimony, which the court apparently did not believe, was that they were never told about these snakes. The only witness that can say or did testify with any claim of certainty that my clients were warned about snakes on the property was Ms. Carol Shell. Now, the judge found that her testimony, she found no reason, he found no reason.
Did your clients testify that had they known that, they would not have gone through with the purchase?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. In any case, what happened, Your Honor, is within a matter of days of taking possession of the house in September 2005, their two-year-old son at the time found a snake laying in their living room. 2 weeks later, they discovered a second bull snake, 3 to 4 foot long, also in the living room. And approximately a month later, a third snake was found. It appears, at least during the record of trial, that those were the only three snakes found in the house during that time. However, they were a precursor of what was to come in the fall of 2005. Several more snakes were seen in the garage, out around the property. It got to the point where children of the McCollums were uncomfortable sleeping in a room by themselves. A hoe was kept at the front door because the snakes would typically gather on the concrete in the front of the house. This is an issue that should have been disclosed. So now that we have the benefit of what happened, we have to look at what exactly were they told. It's undisputed that there was nothing in the property disclosure statement about snakes on the property.
You know, talking about that disclosure statement, most of the things on that disclosure statement, which is established by the legislature, deal with structural defects. When you read those questions and then have that general question that you think they should have answered and said, well, we've had snakes, how would the seller actually know that that's what you're supposed to put on there? And what in, I mean, that general question, because the other questions all deal with structural, including the termites. You have to determine that. There's no question there that says, do you have other varmints around the house, or is it, are you inflicted with coons, raccoons, or mice, or anything else? How would a seller know that you, if you have had, you know, deer chewing on the trees or something around? I mean, how do you know? Where do you draw the line, or how would a seller know what you're supposed to disclose?
Your Honor, I think that's a very fair question. I think I would have two responses. First, this is not a situation where you had a mouse that ran through the house 15 years ago. We're talking about, if you look at, even if you want to set aside my client's testimony, if you simply want to use the defendant's witnesses, we're talking about an inordinate amount of bull snakes on a property. And it would seem to me, when you have a broad question, I think the legislature, and of course I wasn't there, but When they write something as broad as, you know, are there any other problems that have not been disclosed above? And I would think when you reach a number to where you're having someone seeing that many snakes on the property, you're buying snake away to deal with it, you are having a handyman come out and check on it, that is, and Your Honor, this is only what we were willing to get them to admit to.
Tell us, how far into the country is this house, and where does it sit exactly? Is it out in a more of a wildlife area?
I think it's aptly described, and I think counsel for Cahill would probably agree. It's right on the edge of town.
Is it close to the river?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In case you're wondering, it's out in the general vicinity of where the National Guard unit is in Mobird, South Dakota. It's on the edge of town. And I think my clients expected that they might see some wildlife at times. Your Honor, one of the arguments we've heard from Cahill throughout this case is you must have left your doors open because Ms. Shell saw curtains blowing out and maybe you left the doors open. I would submit that if a property has so many snakes on it that you can't leave your door open for an hour for fear of them immediately gaining entrance, then you do have a snake problem on that property, and that's an inordinate amount of snakes. But to get back to your original question...
How is that different than keeping your door closed so field mice don't get in?
I agree with that, except, Your Honor, first of all, we took issue that we just left our doors open for extended periods because there was a two-year-old child on the property. I'm saying even if we assume that fact for the sake of argument... I'm not aware of other properties that I've been on or friends of mine, even those that live 20 miles in the country, where if you leave the door open for an hour, there's so many out there waiting to jump in, they're going to come on in. But to answer your question in terms of, you know, the seller's obligation, apart from the disclosure statement, I think we have to look back at what is the seller seeking here? Specific performance. The law requires that he act fairly and in good faith. And so I would submit that if you're aware of this issue with a property, that if you are going to be acting in good faith and fair with the other side, you would let them know that this is an issue. This court has made it clear in more recent cases that caveat emptor is not the law in South Dakota when it comes to the transfer of real property. The goal here is for parties to act in good faith, tell what they know of the problem. Your Honor, I was reviewing in preparation for this the Englehart case, And I noticed that in that case, the bottom line was there was issues with the basement walls and crumbling. There was actually a disclosure in that case that there had been some issues with the basement walls, but the court found it was insufficient. And there was actually something to put the parties on notice. I want to, because I assume my time is going faster than I probably realize, I want to touch upon a few things that stand out and why this court should be troubled with the decision. Your Honors, there are findings of fact that the court made that are flatly incorrect. And by flatly, I don't mean that maybe the court could have done it this way or there's a little bit of testimony here and there. I'm saying if you look at the court's finding and look at the defendant's evidence, you'll find that it's just simply incorrect. Not my version, the defendant's version. One of the findings, number 29, that the court made was that Cahill never told Opseth, he's the handyman, that he had found a snake in the house. Opseth, at trial, conceded, because he didn't want to initially and direct, but he conceded in cross that in his deposition he had specifically testified that he had been, I said, quote, did he ask you to do something as a result of having found the snake? Did he ask you to come out and check it out? Yes. That was his answer. Another finding, Barbara Raba, another employee of Mr. Cahill. The finding number 126 was, Cahill never told her about finding a snake in the house or various snakes in the yard. If you go to the transcript at 433 to 434, you'll find that Ms. Raba specifically testified not only was she told, she had been told various times. The court's finding number 30, that Opseth only found one bull snake around the house is flatly incorrect with Mr. Opseth's own testimony. Next, I want to talk about what we're here today for. The seller sought specific performance. The plaintiffs initially sued their case out as rescission. Within days, the seller sued the plaintiffs for specific performance. An element of specific performance is they need to have unclean hands when they come to this court. The reason why I think this distinction is important and why I addressed it like I did in the briefs is we recognize that when we come before this court, we carry the burden. We will accept that burden, though, and we are focusing primarily on the grant of specific performance because our burden is different. If we seek to reverse just the rescission, we have to show not only that the trial court abused its discretion because it was an equitable remedy, but we had to have clear and convincing evidence. I will represent to this court that that's a significant burden for us to show. On the flip side, the grant of specific performance also requires an abuse of discretion for us to overturn it. However, we need only show that he did not have unclean hands. And I'm submitting that when you look at this record, you cannot find, and that the court was clearly erroneous when it found, that Cahill had clean hands and therefore is entitled to specific performance.
Is it an either or, that it either has to be rescission or specific performance? Is there another remedy the court could have looked at? So if we would buy into your argument and remand it, is the court then limited by either rescission or limited to rescission?
No, Your Honor. If you'll look at the Bates versus Smith case, this court a number of years ago laid out that they are not mutually exclusive. You don't have to have one to have the other. This court could affirm the denial of the rescission. This court could conclude that my clients simply have not met a clear and convincing burden to show fraud on the part of Mr. Cahill to entitle them to rescission. However, it could also, at the same time, deny and reverse the grant of specific performance. And the reason is, they don't have to be one or the other. This court laid that out in Bates versus Smith. You can affirm that rescission but still deny the specific performance. So the court may wonder, well, where does that leave us? Essentially, Your Honor, I would submit that it would put the parties back to where Mr. Gosch initially said he was going, which was to foreclose on the lien, and I suppose my clients would be losing their down payment and their payments on the house, and the property would revert to Mr. Cahill.
So how does that differ from specific performance?
As it stands now, Your Honor, if the trial court's award is upheld in terms of equity, we would be left with this house that we don't live in, that has not sold, and we would be stuck with the burden of moving this house when we did not create this situation and we were not dealt with fairly by the seller.
What's the difference between that and if they get a judgment against you and then they sell the house to satisfy the judgment, even though they have to make the disposal of it, you get stuck with the deficiency. So there's no difference in the real situation.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, your point's well taken, that in the end, if a claim for damages was brought, maybe the result ends up somewhat similar. But the problem is here, Your Honor, at this point, we have been, when you're looking at the equitable remedy of specific performance, we are being stuck with the problem, even though he did not act fairly in a good faith with us. And I think that would, I think that's just as good of a question, frankly, for Mr. Cahill's counsel, because at the outset they would have had that option as well. But they
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The other thing I will try to come through real quickly here is I think the trial court raised our burden of proof. The court specifically found in conclusion of law number 6, quote, in order for the McCollums to prevail on any of their theories, they must establish that there was a snake problem. This is confirmed in the appellee's brief that was their impression as well. Members of the court, I would submit that the property disclosure statements do not talk in terms of is it a, quote, problem. I don't think the court wants to allow sellers the benefit to later on say, as a matter of public policy, well, I didn't disclose the crumbling walls in the basement because I didn't think it was a, quote, wall problem. The issue is you're supposed to disclose what you know. If you read the cases in terms of caveat emptor is no longer the law, they say the seller should disclose those things of which he is aware, not whether he terms them a problem. Maybe radon gas would not bother the seller, and maybe he doesn't think it's a problem. But if you have certain things that need to be disclosed, You need to tell them what you know about the property. That's the end result.
I mean, it could be birds singing outside. I mean, it has to be something that's a problem, isn't it? It has to have some relation to a problem with the home.
I agree.
It can't be everything you know about the home. You could write a book about that.
I agree, Your Honor, and I appreciate the birds singing. The issue here, though, is it's an objective question, and I think if we objectively look at what Mr. Cahill knew about this home, I think a reasonable person would find that when you're finding bull snakes in the house, in the garage, all over the property on that frequency, a frequency that despite it being their witnesses, we're bringing out all these dead snakes. It was my client who actually pointed out to me the significance of the fact that all the snakes seemed to be dead that the defendant's witnesses were willing to talk about. What does that mean? He stepped back and he pointed out to me during the trial, he said, the fact that they're all dead means one of two things. They all lined up over the fence or on the concrete and just happened to die there, or someone killed them and left them there. The interesting thing is, though, although Ms. Neville will talk about all the witnesses that were in the house and there all the time, none of them ever seemed to see living snakes. It
Your
seems
time
odd.
Has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Neville, you have 20 minutes.
Neil Cahill in this case. It is essential at this point to point out the procedural posture of this case. This case is here before this court as an equitable case with equitable remedies, not on summary judgment, but a case that was actually tried to the court. The court reviewed all the evidence, judged the demeanor and the credibility of the witnesses, and made a well-reasoned, factually found decision in this case.
What about the findings of fact that are clearly erroneous? What if we were to agree that there are, when you comb the record, there really aren't, there is not evidence to support some of those findings?
There are, of course, several findings that both parties have argued about, and if this court were to go through and find some that were not supported, like the three that he mentioned, say that, and I haven't gone back to see whether that is truly the case, but say they are not supported by the record. There's no prejudice in this case because those individual findings could be thrown out entirely and the same decision could be made.
So is that what we would need to do if we found that those were clearly erroneous? We
Yes.
just look at the rest of them to see if there's enough evidence to support the trial court's decision?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because the test here is not whether this court would have made the same decision or made the same findings. The test is whether there is evidence to support the decision that the court made in this case.
Did the trial court ever indicate why he apparently believed Mr. Cahill in contrast to all the other witnesses?
I'm not sure I'm following, Your Honor.
Well,
believe Mr. Cahill
he apparently bought Mr. Cahill's testimony, which was that he had only seen one snake inside the house in 30 years. He had only seen one in the garage, and he'd only seen one outside the garage.
As to the snake in the house, there was no other witness that testified to ever seeing snakes in the house. And, in fact, the McCullums only testified to seeing two. Now, Kelly McCullum said, yes, there was a third snake, but when Michelle McCullum was asked about it, she says, well, I didn't see that one.
Well, there's Dick Wendt, who, for some reason, said there was 30 to 50 snakes down in the basement, and they're all trying to get up the stairs.
Yes. He testified that as he stood at the top of the basement, he flipped the light on and looked down into the basement. In approximately a 10 to 15 square foot area, he saw 30 to 50 snakes. At a time when there were several employees in and out of that basement on a daily basis, Christy Reichert testified she was there twice a week. B.J. Schaefer testified he was there twice a week. Barb Rava said she was there as many as three times a week. And his cleaning lady was there on a daily basis during the same time frame, and no one miraculously saw 30 to 50 snakes.
So did the trial court say this man's an outright liar, or this man's making it up, or hallucinating, or drunk, or something like this? What's going on?
That's exactly the case, Your Honor. The trial court decided this person was not credible, did not believe his testimony, and threw the testimony out, which he is entitled to do.
Now, what reasons did he give? He found that the McCollums were not credible, What reasons did he give for that, and what reasons did he give for the credibility of Mr. Cahill?
With regard to the McCollums, he didn't necessarily say they were not credible, but the testimony regarding the number of snakes and the frequency, it was, I saw a snake one time here, and I saw a snake one time here, but he admits, well, I didn't kill them every time, so it could have been the same snake. And then there was also the issue that when he testified...
Yeah, but both Mr. and Mrs. McCollum said that they saw somewhere around 30 to 50 snakes, you know.
But there was no corroboration between, okay, was this 30 to 50 times? Was it different times? Was it the snake? There was no way that he could identify a number.
I know, but you're looking at a 2 or 3 year period of time as opposed to Mr. Cahill in 30 years seeing one outside, one in the garage, and one in the house.
It just wasn't consistent with the rest of the evidence, Your Honor. It just wasn't consistent. All of the other evidence, the actual physical evidence, was regarding the same two snakes, the photograph, the killed snakes that they froze in a tub, the videotape, they admit all was the same two snakes. There just wasn't credible evidence to say, here's we were having such a huge problem that, oh, by the way, we never talked to the DENR, we never talked to pest control, we never got anyone out here to take care of this. Well, I guess we didn't do anything at all. And, oh, and we stayed in the house for over a year after we knew there was a problem. The court just didn't believe the testimony of the people that if it was so bad that you had to keep a hole behind your door and you couldn't walk out on the front step, why weren't you telling somebody? Why weren't you doing something to fix it?
But what about the issue that the trial court held the plaintiffs to a higher burden and that they had to show a snake problem? Obviously, when you look at all this, there were snakes on the. I mean, you'd have to admit there were bull snakes on this property. There were dead ones. There were live ones. You know, we're just arguing here about how many there were, but there were snakes there. And my understanding is what they're saying is your client should have indicated that on that sheet. That, by the way, this is Mobridge, you're going to have snakes around here. Should he have said that? Should that be on that?
Well, there's two parts to your question, so I'm going to separate those. First, you asked, well, did he elevate the burden of proof because he said you have to prove a snake problem? No. The question was, are there any other problems? So to say you should have disclosed it under this section, well, okay, but if that's the case, then don't you have to prove it was a snake problem? Because otherwise, what, as Justice Konenkamp pointed out, how would we know that having one snake in our house in 30 years' time, or how would we know that living in Mobridge, when you have snakes outside, how would we know that would be something we have to disclose? Like the deer's chewing on the trees, or maybe we get a squirrel in the attic or a bat in the attic, which everyone in Vermilion knows is common. You know, these are things that you have to know what you have to disclose. There has to be a limit. And then to say, well, this is an objective question. It doesn't matter what Neil Cahill thought or what he believed. I agree. It absolutely is an objective question. But no reasonable person would look at that question and say, yeah, I had a snake in my house during the 30 years of the time I lived here. I better disclose that on my property condition disclosure statement. It's not something someone would think of. It's not out of the ordinary, and it's not unreasonable. And to see even Christy Reicher, who is the only witness beyond Mr. Wentz, who testified to seeing several snakes on the property, that was over an 8-year period. So sure, if you see 5 to 10 snakes, and that was the most, and she wasn't sure if it was even that. She knew it was 2, but maybe as many as 5 or 10 over an 8-year period. That's not unreasonable, that is not unusual, and it's not an inordinate amount of snakes.
But doesn't that raise a question as to the credibility of Mr. Cahill? They only come by there in passing, and they see quite a few snakes and testify about them. He lives there for 30 years and sees less snakes than anybody else, even though he's been there for 30 years.
And, you know, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I can only tell you what he testified to what he saw and what the other witnesses testified to what he saw, and that the court judged that credibility and demeanor. And the test here today is not whether this court would make the same finding, but whether his findings were supported by the evidence in the record. I'm a little bit confused by opposing counsel's argument with respect to the specific performance. I'm not sure whether he was saying We needed to show that there was bad faith or unclean hands on their part, or we needed to show that we didn't have any unclean hands. I think the facts of this case that go back to how it actually occurred show the unclean hands on their part. Payments were consistently late. They were supposed to pay us the $100,000 when they sold the house in April of 2005, did not do so, or 2006, did not do so, but also hid it from us. Didn't tell us, hey, we sold the house, we can't get to the payment right away, can you wait, or we can only get you half right now. Didn't say a word. Didn't even say a word about having this terrible snake problem that they needed to move out of the house with. But then when we found out that they had sold the house in July of 2006 and said, where's the $100,000? Now it was a snake problem, and we don't want to go through with the sale. They told us by notice in August of 2006 that there was such a bad snake problem that we don't want to go through with this house, but they didn't mention anything about rescission. The first notice we got of rescission was when they filed the complaint, and then they didn't actually tender the house back until December of 2006. Now, to be eligible for rescission, they have to have used due diligence. They have to have offered the house back within a reasonable period of time. And in this case, while, as the trial court found, there are many damages that could be remedied with money, there was one injury that could not be remedied with money. And now the appellant come before this court and they say, well, let's split the baby. You know, you don't have to award specific performance. You can still deny specific performance and deny rescission, and we can go back and have this new trial on the issue of damages, which is exactly what it would require. There are three reasons why this court should not do that. First, there was absolutely no evidence put on by appellants with respect to how much there was a diminution in value of the property or how much they lost or how much there would be in damages, because this was not a case under the property condition disclosure statement statute. They needed out of that contract. That $100,000 was gone, and they needed out of it. So they did not put on any of this evidence. And if the court were to say, we're going to send it back, it would require another trial.
You're saying the $100,000 was spent?
Yes. $50,000 was used on a down payment for a new house, and the other $50,000, we don't know where it went. Michelle McCollum testified, and the appellants would like you to believe what the trial court would not. That money was put into her husband's account and she never asked him where it went. It's just not credible. So again, these are some of the little things that the court heard and didn't believe. The other two reasons stem to sort of the same theory, and that is it's not equitable. This is an equitable case with equitable remedies. And to say we're not going to grant either specific performance and rescission, and we're going to send this back for another trial on damages, would leave the appellee with no remedy at law because of that one injury that can't be remedied by money. That is that the house is now perceived and commonly known in the community as the house with the snake problem. We hear it all over the place. The house with the snake problem. And as rumors are wont to do, they will not diminish with time. They will increase with time and telling. And that is not something that we can fix with money. That's not something we could fix with a positive ruling from the trial court or even this court. The other issue is that we did have clean hands, and it would be inequitable to us, to Appellee Cahill, to say, you know, we're going to make you go back and suffer these damages, even though you didn't do anything wrong and couldn't possibly have known you were supposed to disclose one snake in your house in 30 years' time. And it was always the snake in the house, not the snakes on the property that was discussed. Now, appellants kind of mix apples and oranges in that argument with respect to the good faith argument, and say, well, you know, you didn't even argue about this in your brief, so you apparently have waived it. That's not true. That would be like me saying, well, at page 19 of your brief, you actually said we were entitled to specific performance. I know what they meant, this court knows what they meant, and this court also knows what we meant in the way that we argued it.
As of the date of the court's decision, who had possession of the home?
The appellant Cahill's, McCollum's had possession of the home. We never did take back the house, even though it was offered on December 6th of 06. The issue with good faith, and again, they stay away from the whole property condition disclosure statement and suing under 43.442 because they need it out of the contract. So they talk about, well, yeah, but you should have told us, you should have acted in good faith, and you should have disclosed it. So it's kind of a double argument. But if you're just talking about the good faith issue and not actually the property condition disclosure statement, then oral disclosure is enough. Despite the court's ruling in Crofton, and I understand in Fuller versus Crofton, the court said, you know, oral disclosure is not enough. But that's when we're talking in the context of the actual property condition disclosure statement. Here, they're just talking about whether it was good faith to disclose or not to disclose the one snake 20 years ago that he had in the house, and he dropped a book of carpet samples on it. In this case, the court made a finding based on three people's testimony, not just Carol Shell's, as the appellant would like you to believe, but based on three people's testimony, that was actually disclosed. He did tell him it was an anecdotal conversation. It was not meant to be, hey, you should know, I had this snake in my house. It might be a problem. It was a story. They talked about it. Mr. McCullum said, you know, we had snakes in winter. It's not a problem. He even relayed that conversation to Barb Raba on a separate incident. So Barb testified, yeah, he told me about this. And Neil Cahill testified to the same, substantially the same circumstances, although his dates were a little mixed up. And then so did Carol Shell. Finally, with respect to, I do want to point out before I run out of time, with respect to the issue of the, I guess, reputation of the house, for lack of a better word, This was an issue of contention with the parties before we went to trial, and appellants made a motion in limine that said, we don't want you eliciting testimony that this rumor about the house is spread in the community. We lost on that motion in limine, and every time Mr. Gosch attempted to put in the evidence, it was objected to, and the court sustained it. Until Mr. Burke elicited the information himself on cross-examination from one of our witnesses, Tawny Quenzer, and he asked her, has anyone told you about this house having snakes in the house? And she said yes. Well, who told you that? Mr. McCullum. That is evidence that supports the need for specific performance. There is no evidence of unclean hands on the behalf of the Cahill, and there is evidence of unclean hands on behalf of the McCullum. For those reasons, we are entitled to specific performance. And this court should not go back and say, well, you know, I probably wouldn't have found that fact like he did, or I wouldn't have found this fact. The decision is whether he had a well-supported decision and whether there were facts in the record that would support that decision. And briefly, with respect to the rescission, I realize that appellants have said, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that today because of the burden of proof, and we would agree and reiterate it is a very strong burden of proof. There's clear and convincing evidence rather than just the preponderance of the evidence, but even the court said, I don't even think there was a preponderance of the evidence for proof in this case that there was a snake problem such that it needed to be disclosed. And as we went through with respect to the property condition disclosure statement, if you're going to complain about the question, are there any other problems, then certainly you have to say we had a snake problem, and you have to prove that. In this case, there are several legal theories. You know, they argued failure of consideration, mistake, fraud, all of those as support of that same theory, but they all stem from the same factual issue. Was there a snake problem? If you don't prove the snake problem, you can't show mistake. If you don't prove the snake problem, you can't show failure of consideration. Regardless of whether they testified, as Justice Meyer-Henry suggested, that, hey, you know, if we'd known about this, we would never have bought the house. But then, even after you go through all of those issues, then the last question has to become, well, did you waive this? Because you did not diligently offer the property back as is required. For example, in Wolken versus Wade, Justice Zinter authored that opinion that said, you know, when you come up with an excuse after the fact, when you're already in default on the contract and you come up with an excuse after the fact,
2 minutes,
we're not going to allow you to use that to get out of the contract or to rescind the contract. And that's exactly what happened here. So even if they were successful on those other issues, they would still lose on the issue of waiver. And I would just point the court to the case of Knudsen versus Jensen, because that sets out the steps that they would have to go through in proving the mistake or failure of consideration. And then, again, comes down to the reasonable diligence. And SDCL 5311-4 says, you know, if you had the opportunity to get an inspection and you relied on your 9 or 10 visits to the house in this case, we're not going to shift the burden here of any mistake that may or may not have occurred. And if you don't take the time or the diligence to offer the house back when you want to rescind the contract as soon as you know there's a problem, then we're not going to shift the burden. We're not going to make someone else pay for what may have been your mistake.
Assuming you win this case, how do you expect to avoid the snake problem? You get specific performance. They cannot pay, or you get a judgment for a deficiency. You end up going through the sheriff and selling the house, and then they're liable for the deficiency. So isn't it your problem anyway to sell the house and get a deficiency and then go after them further?
It is, but then the amount of the remaining judgment would be a judgment that we would have against the appellant. So if there is damage to the reputation of the house, which diminishes the value of the house, as we contend that there is, then that amount, that diminishment of the value, would then be a judgment we would be entitled to. And so, you know, whether we get paid eventually or not.
So either way, it's going to come out the same either way, isn't it? Except if, unless they got rescission.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. If we were to foreclose on the house and we were to sell it and have no issues with the sale, yes, we would have, they would have a certain amount of time, of course, to redeem, and whether they want to keep the house or sell the house, that would be their burden and to their advantage to get as much out of it as they could. But then we wouldn't be fighting the issue of the reputation of the house, because they would be the ones that would be dealing with selling it and determining whether they could convince somebody it doesn't have a snake problem.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Burke, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin by saying, first of all, if you'll go to the transcript, page 50, the representation was made here today that my clients first brought up a snake issue after they were in default on the house. If you go to page 50 of the transcript, you'll find that Mr. McCollum specifically testified to calling Mr. Gosh, because they had negotiated with Mr. Gosh and Mr. Gosh had prepared the contract for deed. Mr. McCollum called Mr. Gosh when they first started noticing snakes, after he had called Cahill, called the handyman Opseth, he called Mr. Gosh. And Mr. Gosh had apparently agreed to contact pest control. That was in the fall of 2005. They were not in default. They raised the snake issue then, well before there was a claim for rescission. I also should point out that I think it's easy for counsel for Mr. Cahill to stand here today and say, why didn't they call Game Fish and Parks, animal control, the local extension agent? I'm not so sure that I would have done those things if I were in the McCollum's position, but I think it's interesting now that these great ideas from Mr. Cahill all come now after we're in trial. They were on the phone with Mr. Gosh in the fall of 2005. If those were easy solutions to the snake problem, Mr. Gosh might have suggested it to my clients at that time. He didn't. I want to move back to Mr. Wendt's testimony. I understand that the court found him not credible, and Your Honor, I think, Justice Sabers, I think your questions are very good. If you read the court's finding, he did not find that he had a drinking issue, was insane, was trying to help somebody out, or just, you know, I think loony was the word you might have used. Your Honor, this is a farmer-owner-rancher in the Glenham area, worked for NBU for 27 years, didn't even know the McCollums till I tracked this guy down because I had heard what he knew about this house. He didn't know my clients. He had no relationship with them. The only party, if any, that he had a relationship with was Mr. Cahill, and that was because he built this unattached garage in 1998. He testified, not in generalities, but specifically talked about Mr. Cahill taking him in the house, showing him to the top of the stair, and him seeing these 30 to 50 snakes in the basement. 30 to 50 snakes at one time. He then went on, and I think the specificity is important when you're looking in terms of judging someone's credibility. He talked about the fact that Cahill was opining about maybe they were coming in through the front, underneath the porch, and how he might remedy it. This was his testimony. There was no Perry Mason-like cross where Mr. Went broke down, and it was clear that he didn't know what he was talking about. There was nothing like that. The court's sole basis for not finding him credible was that there were other employees of Cahill who said they were there that same summer and didn't see 30 to 50 snakes in the basement. I don't claim to be a snake expert, but the fact that other people may have cleaned the house or been in the house on various days throughout that same year doesn't mean that this man got on the stand and perjured himself. I think it's tough when you look at the testimony, which you'll have the benefit of, to simply say it's not credible because other people didn't see what he saw. This is not a situation which one of the cases cited by the appellee was Goebel versus Warner Transportation, I believe, where the Justice Center, I believe you're on the trial bench, and I think Justice Gilbertson wrote the opinion where you talked about you can throw out a witness's testimony. And they rely upon that case to say, well, you can throw out Mr. Wendt's testimony. In that case, that gentleman, the department found, had knowingly testified false twice, had changed his story several times. That's not what we had here. There was no cross that brought out different versions from Mr. Wendt. There was only one version. It was simply disregarded.
But, you know, we have to give deference to the trial court. I mean, there was obviously all kinds of conflicting evidence.
I agree, Your Honor, and that's what makes, frankly, the appeal difficult, except I think the court, if it's going to find a basis to find that a man's not credible and essentially came in and perjured himself for a party that he has no affiliation with, there should be more basis other than simply saying, well, these other people were there during the same year and they didn't see anything when they were there.
Well, the judge didn't say he perjured himself. The judge just said he didn't believe the testimony. He could have been mistaken. He could have remembered a different house. It's one thing to say that a person isn't credible on a point, and another thing to say that they're committing perjury. I don't think the judge went that far, did he?
He did not say, no, he's committing perjury. I'm essentially saying that's, in effect, the result. What we come down to is this. Opposing counsel said it's the little things. And here's the little things. We know there was no written disclosure. The only evidence of an oral disclosure comes from Ms. Schell. Now, here's something that I find interesting. When opposing counsel made her argument, she said, why would Mr. Cahill think of it? Why would you think to need to disclose the fact that there was a snake in the house? I don't know, but they're claiming he did just that. They actually claim that he disclosed this snake in oral conversations. Now, if that's true, and it's already on the table, why wouldn't you put it in the property disclosure statement? If you've already told the buyer this bad thing about the house, why wouldn't you write it down in the property disclosure statement? That didn't happen, if it's out on the table. And if we want to talk about credibility, there's two things that need to be known because we have to look, is there a written disclosure? It's undisputed, there's none. So they're hanging their hat on an oral disclosure that was testified to by Ms. Schell. Now here's what I want to be clear about Ms. Schell's testimony. She's the same witness that said, I've never seen snakes on his property. And then after impeachment, admitted that she had seen a dead one on the road, a dead one hanging over a fence, a skin coming out of a hole. She's the same person that said, I dealt with Jackie Heil and her husband, who also looked at this same house, and the snake story was told to them. Jackie Heil came and testified. We looked at that house 3 to 4 times. She's a realtor there in town, and said, we were never told about a snake problem either. We have these inconsistencies even with their own testimony, but the only evidence of this oral disclosure that they're hanging their hat on comes from Ms. Schell. The stigma that is allegedly attached to the house is, my concern with that evidence is there was this universal stigma that was found by the court from maybe a half a dozen witnesses who testified at trial for the defendant. And you have to keep in mind that of the defendant's witness, I think, with the exception of one, They are all existing employees, former employees, or have power of attorney over Mr. Cahill. So if you want to talk about bias, I guess we can show that.
Now, did you have an opportunity to argue all of this to the trial court as well?
I did, Your Honor. I did. I began my brief before this court by saying a mistake has been made. I come here asking, trying to implore this court to understand that we had the evidence at trial. We had the witness who said there were 30 to 50 snakes in this house shown to him by the seller that has there's no basis for him to make that up, no finding that he had any connection to the party or anything like that. Thank you. Looking back, there's two things that maybe could have been different. I was not the original lawyer for the McCullums in this case. Maybe, had I been, I might have done things differently. They had a different attorney. So I will not second-guess him on whether he should have done things differently with Mr. Gosch early on. And looking back, maybe had I been the McCullums' attorney in the fall of 2005, I would have had them hang on to more snakes and get more photos of snakes. The simple fact of the matter is they kept a few of them frozen. That photo is in evidence. They found the snake away. We have all these witnesses. Even if you take my client's testimony away, we have a number of the defendant's witnesses finding all these dead snakes. And Justice Sabres, I think you're right on the money when you say, doesn't that call into question the credibility of Mr. Cahill, who seems to have found the least, and where are all these dead snakes coming from? It means someone killed them, but yet all the witnesses who were there every day have no idea who killed them. They just happened to die there. My clients didn't mark every snake, didn't hang on to every snake, but the numbers are such that there is clearly a problem. And they never assumed, frankly, that they wouldn't be believed when they're fighting a problem like this. And there was a problem. They held on as long as they could, and they eventually moved to a different home because, frankly, you can only take that sort of living so long when you keep a hoe at the front door and your kids don't want to sleep in the room. You can imagine the strain it puts on a husband and wife. Eventually, we came to the court seeking relief. And I stand here today saying that if the seller wants specific performance, I do need to clear one thing up. Your Honor, you said you questioned would it come out the same. I don't think so, Justice Sabres, and here's why. If this decision is affirmed, I think it says bad policy in South Dakota about caveat emptor, about what a seller needs to tell buyers in South Dakota. The result's not the same.
Your time's expired, Mr. Burke. Thank you.
Just one statement or question. I'm not saying that it makes no difference. I'm saying it makes no difference in damages who ends up foreclosing on whom or whatever.
Thank you.
Justice Sabres gets the last word. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.